I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a moment, the debate over embedding anthropologists in the field with troops in Iraq and Afghanistan. But first, Congress, the White House, and telephone companies are wrestling over domestic surveillance, what information phone companies have already handed over to federal agents about their customers, and whether they should continue in the future. Verizon has told lawmakers that since 2005, the FBI, without a court warrant, asked not only for the name and financial information of some customers, but information about people those customers called and people they called. This week, Congress is debating how to revamp the law on government surveillance and whether to grant immunity to phone companies being sued for violating customer privacy. For the latest, we turn to Wall Street Journal reporter Evan Perez, who joins us from Washington. And Evan, AT&T, Quest, and Verizon all sent letters to lawmakers who demanded answers from them. What, in general, are the phone companies telling them?
Well, the phone companies are basically trying to respond to what they feel is the overall impression that what they've been doing is illegal, and so it's a very rare that they've actually spoken out on this issue. Pretty much because the White House has ordered them not to, has told them that that all of this is covered under State Secret Act, and so the phone companies are basically now trying to at least defend themselves in as indirect a way as they can, and are basically saying that we've been cooperating with the government without court warrants for years, and there's nothing wrong with that.
Well, you say for years. How much is Congress motivated by news from last week when court records of former Quest Communications CEO Joseph Nocio were unsealed? The records reveal that he says that the National Security Agency asked Quest for information about customers without a court order before the 9/11 terror attacks. That would seem to be a stunning revelation.
It was a very surprising revelation, and the several members of Congress have now written letters to the administration, to the Justice Department, and to the Director of National Intelligence, asking for a fuller explanation. We've always believed that that it was not until after 9/11 that President Bush ordered this warrantless wiretapping program run by the National Security Agency.
Well, and we should say that Quest Communications, unlike AT&T and Verizon, said that they did not follow FBI requests and did not give any consumer information. But we're also finding out from some of the information that the phone companies are providing now that the information that was given wasn't just about the war on terrorism. In at least one case, information helped in a crime.
That's right. I mean, they describe helping the U.S. Marshals, for example, in earlier this year, to try to find a fugitive who had assaulted a pregnant woman. They've been involved in other help in helping finding missing children.
Well, the phone companies are being sued by different groups, but we understand the Bush administration is pushing Congress to grant blanket immunity for anyone assisting the government. What are the chances of that passing?
Well, the administration is insisting that it must pass. The Democrats are right now standing firm, but they are saying that they are open to the idea of giving the telecommunications companies immunity that they're asking for. But first, what they want to know is, you know, what did the phone companies do? What kind of help did they offer? The question is, you know, how can you give immunity for something that you don't know anything about?
Bottom line, do we have a sense of, you know, how much information about Americans was given out by the phone companies?
We're beginning to get a sense. I mean, we get this letter from Verizon that was issued yesterday to the Congress. And, you know, they released some real numbers, which are some of the first numbers we've seen on this. They basically said they received about 88,000 requests for customer information in 2006 from law enforcement. And so that seems like a very high number. I think members of Congress are now asking the administration to give a little bit more information about what those requests are about. What kind of information is it? What information about customers is being collected and by whom?
And going forward, is it assumed that any relationship between the phone companies and the government would have to be overseen by a court such as the FISA court?
Yeah, it does look like the from now on, from here on out, because there's so much suspicion that the FISA court and other courts are going to have to play a bigger role, simply because the administration is not trusted on Capitol Hill. It's not trusted by a lot of people when they say, "Don't worry about it. We're just doing things, you know, to catch terrorists."
Evan Perez, staff writer for The Wall Street Journal in Washington, D.C. Evan, thank you.
Thank you.
Amid the controversy surrounding the use of private contractors, another one is brewing over the U.S. military's use of anthropologists in Iraq and Afghanistan. These so-called human terrain teams, you might call them embedded scholars, are helping military commanders navigate cultural thickets in two countries. They say it's saving lives, and we'll hear from one of the participating anthropologists in a few minutes. But some other anthropologists say it's violating professional ethics. A group calling itself the Network of Concerned Anthropologists is urging colleagues to sign a pledge not to participate in counterinsurgency. David Price, a professor of anthropology at St. Martin's University in Lacey, Washington, is co-author of that pledge and also author of an upcoming book on the use of anthropologists in World War II. He says that four anthropologists were accused of using their credentials as a front for espionage in the First World War. And espionage is not his only concern, as we'll hear. We'll start with David. Welcome.
Hello. It's nice to speak with you, Robin.
We first heard about this topic over a year ago when author George Packer reported on the Australian anthropologist David Kilcullen moving into the Pentagon to shape the program that is now in place that we're about to speak of. He called this armed social work. Why do you think this is against the ethics code?
There are a lot of questions about exactly what's going on with this research that, you know, falls under the general title of human terrain. The first involves whether or not meaningful, voluntary, informed consent is going on with this research that's going on in the field with anthropologists who are either armed themselves or are traveling with people who are armed, going out and interviewing people. There are all sorts of questions about how voluntary anyone's cooperation is in assisting such research.
And an anthropologist, what, has to really make sure when you're in the field that people know they're being studied?
Absolutely. All research ethics codes, they all at their fundamental base, whether it's sociology, medical research, anthropology, psychology, require participation in human research be voluntary.
So that's your first concern.
Yeah.
What are the others?
The second one is the Code of the American Anthropological Association asks that no harm come to studied populations. While I understand and appreciate that the goal of human terrain research is fundamentally to help come up with cultural information that can be used to help inform the troops so that they make better judgments and are able to negotiate better, there are questions that are raised about if they're studying entire populations, some of those populations are eventually going to be targeted. And as the piece that ran in the Boston Globe indicates, some members of the Pentagon seem to look at this program as an extension of the CORDS program from the Vietnam era, which was the Civil Operations and Revolutionary Development Support Project that essentially targeted people for assassinations. So the fact that someone in the Pentagon raises that question is very troubling.
Yes, you're referring to Brian Bender's article in the Boston Globe in which he quoted a Pentagon official who did liken the new human terrain units to the units that were used in Vietnam. And as you point out, some of the people that anthropologists spoke to were later assassinated by the U.S. But the article also quotes several anthropologists who are working with the military who say, look, I don't want to help them kill people. This is Brian Selmeski. He's a researcher at the Royal Military College of Canada and an anthropologist. And he says, what I want to do is help them avoid conflict. Jim Peacock, another anthropologist at the University of North Carolina, says he feels the same way, that the idea is to especially teach military personnel before they deploy so that they don't do harm when they get to a country.
I share those views. I'm not opposed to anthropologists engaging with the military. What I'm worried about is these in-the-field operations.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of my research is historic research. I've just finished a book on World War II anthropology, where anthropologists did an extraordinary amount of very interesting work for military and intelligence agencies. Some of this best work had to do with informing troops before they went abroad with the cultures they'd encounter so that they would act appropriately.
In fact, there was a book from World War II that many wished had been duplicated for the Iraq invasion that told troops, you know, some of the cultural differences.
That's right. Yeah, I'm not opposed to any of that. Human terrain goes far beyond that. You know, I think anthropologists have a great service they can do to educate people about the cultures they're going to encounter. But when anthropologists are out in the field in an armed context, that's a whole different situation. You know, the third ethical concern I have is a very basic one, and that's that researchers must identify themselves and who they work for. And I'm troubled by the piece that ran in the New York Times where there's an anthropologist identified inquiries with David Rode, who wrote the piece, it doesn't sound like she's fully identifying herself. And again, if people are out doing research, they need to fully disclose who they are, what's being done, and they need to be identified. I'm troubled that an anthropologist would not identify themselves fully in the press or anywhere else, and they're doing research. Yet in the same piece, the people that are being studied are identified. The New York Times piece had video links on their webpage where you could go and see these villagers that are being interviewed, and the anthropologist is kept off camera. This is very troubling because anthropology has a history in the past of being aligned with colonialism, where just these sorts of things happen, where the people studied are made visible, but the anthropologists are kept out of sight.
You mentioned the woman in the New York Times article. She only identifies herself as Tracy, who's with one of the units in Afghanistan. For instance, gives a couple of examples of what she's done in the field with American military. In one case, noticed that there was a high concentration of widows in one village with young sons. And she explained to the military, if you do something for those widows so that they have some income, their young sons may not feel as if they have to go to the Taliban, to an insurgency, to support their family. And sure enough, a job program was started. In another case, she was able to tell them what the killing of a tribal leader really meant in a bigger picture so that they could prevent tribal warfare. How do you feel about that kind of interaction, you know, interpreting what's happening on the ground so that the military takes something other than military action?
You know, again, my questions are about what's going on in the field. How is the anthropologist approaching people? How are they identifying them? Are the people completely free to talk to them or not without any sort of consequence? I'm not opposed to anthropologists giving advice. I'm not opposed to anthropologists weighing in on policy. Quite frankly, if people listened to anthropologists, we wouldn't be the mess in we're in Iraq. I think anthropologists have a lot to say. But I worry about the sort of conditions, in battle conditions. Going out and gathering information does not necessarily, even if it's an anthropologist doing it, does not necessarily mean it's anthropology.
David Price, professor of anthropology at St. Martin's University in Lacey, Washington. His new book about anthropologists' contributions during World War II will be published this winter. David, we look forward to it, and thanks for speaking with us.
Well, thank you very much, Robin.
Well, why not, as David just implied, just train troops to think like anthropologists? Anthropologist Montgomery McFadge says the military is doing that and doing a better job than in the past, but she says that will never reach the level of trained social scientists. Montgomery works for the Army. She says she's not militarizing anthropology, she's anthropologizing the military. We're going to speak to her. And later in the program, just a quick note, we'll check in Beijing, where the Communist Party elite are meeting to outline the future. Is it possible a future leader may be a former student protester at Tiananmen Square? That's later, but we're back in 1 minute with Montgomery and her thoughts here and now. We're back with more of our conversation about the military's use of anthropologists in Iraq and Afghanistan. These human terrain teams have provoked quite a bit of debate among anthropologists. Some say they violate the code of research ethics. We just heard from David Price of St. Martin's University in Washington State. But other anthropologists say they can prevent harm in war zones. Montgomery McFadge is a senior social science advisor for the U.S. Army's human terrain system. She's involved in training and recruiting the teams. Montgomery, your critics accuse you of militarizing anthropology. You say it's the other way around. You are anthropologizing the military. What do you mean by that?
What I mean by that is anthropologists have a tremendous door that's open to them right now. It gives them the opportunity to influence not just the military, but the entire Department of Defense and more broadly the United States government to think differently and to approach problems in perhaps a more enlightened, more compassionate way.
Give me one, you know, concrete example of just, I mean, it may be a small thing, but what's one example of how you can help the military?
The best evidence for the success of a program like this, of actually embedding social scientists along with a team of other military and civilian experts, is that it actually helps the military to come up with better, more effective courses of action that are less lethal, that require less firepower, but that give them the same result. So in other words, why go in and cordon and search a village and alienate an entire village? Why not actually ask the villagers to conduct a shura, a community meeting, find out what they need and provide it to them and let them make the decision about whether or not they want to support the Taliban?
We've read about human trained teams that informed the military that mothers in a village told them that if their sons had a job program, they wouldn't join the Taliban, so the military started a jobs program. There have been other examples given. But you know the criticism. People like David Price, who we just spoke with, say we don't mind advice from Washington, but it's when anthropologists are on the ground in the field that problems arise. Do you see that difference?
The fact of the matter is that the war takes place at brigade level. In other words, if you want to help the military develop better courses of action, to not cordon and search the village, but to go and talk to the village elders, having a 15,000-mile-long screwdriver coming from Washington, D.C. to fix what's going on at the brigade, it's not very effective. If you want to actually change how the military operates and help them to do a better, less lethal job, then you do need to have people deployed with the unit sitting there like an angel on the shoulder of the commander 24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
Let's get to some of the concerns, and I know you've heard them. First of all, do you worry that information that anthropologists give the military in the field in Iraq or Afghanistan will be used against Iraqis or Afghans? In Vietnam, the Civil Operations and Revolutionary Development Support Project, which I know you're aware of, and which a military spokesman today likened to today's teams, in Vietnam, they helped identify Vietnamese suspects who were then later assassinated.
The intent of the program is not to identify who the bad actors are out there. The military has an entire intelligence apparatus geared and designed to provide that information to them. That is not the information that they need from social scientists.
Well, will social scientists have the right to hold back information if they feel it will endanger someone in the field?
That's already happened. It's happened a number of times. I mean, there's always a certain amount of discretion in an environment like this.
What about oversight? That's another concern that, you know, who has oversight of the program?
We would like to set up a board of advisors. At the moment, however, this program is a proof of concept, which means it's not a permanent program. It's an experiment. It's been in existence for less than a year. So if anyone would like to participate in being on such a board of advisors, they need only to contact us.
What about anthropologists either being used as spies or, you know, slipping over that, you know, down that slope? In David Price's upcoming book, he talks about anthropologists accused of using their work as cover for spy work in World War I. You've already said that anthropologists can hold back information if they want in this program, but do you worry that information might be taken and used as espionage?
Well, espionage involves either something covert or clandestine, and this program is neither of those things. If it were, I wouldn't be here on Here and Now talking to you. In addition, anthropologists are not being used as spies in any sense, since they're out there in uniform with their name on their uniform.
That's interesting, because another concern is that in the recent New York Times article, there was an anthropologist on one of the teams in the field who only gave her first name, so she couldn't be identified. But the newspaper had pictures and video of the people she was interviewing, so they weren't identified.
The general policy is that the social scientists and the teams should identify themselves. In practice, sometimes that doesn't happen because the researchers themselves, particularly if they're interacting with people in an area where they don't feel that they're secure, sometimes they do not identify themselves by their last name, but in theory they should.
And, you know, about that security, anthropologists have worked very hard to earn a sort of independent reputation when they go research people. That's why you all have the code of ethics. You're not aligned with any faction. Do you worry that anthropologists will now be viewed as being part of the military by peoples who really may not understand that this is a special team, you know, but that this might endanger other anthropologists going into fields who are not with the military? They might be perceived as being with the military.
The most significant element of the American Anthropological Association's code of ethics is do no harm. If you're concerned about doing no harm, then you should probably consider joining this program. That is the goal of the program, to help the military do less harm.
That's what other anthropologists who have been involved in the program have said, that their whole goal is to have less conflict, less death, less harm. And I guess I'm picking up in your voice as well. This has been a tough debate within the anthropology community.
you were asking earlier about the courts program in Vietnam. A lot of anthropologists, especially historians of anthropologists like David, who I much admire, they look backwards in time, and they don't actually know very much about what the military does now because they've held themselves back from being involved directly. They want to keep their hands clean.
Because of what happened in Vietnam, you're saying?
And they look back to the past, and they have a bad taste in their mouth because of things that were done 50 or 60 years ago. I would say in that regard, the military has actually learned from history in the same way that anthropologists have learned from history. And they're trying to do a better job, and they actually do need help.
Montgomery McFate is the Senior Social Science Advisor for the U.S. Army's Human Terrain System, speaking to us from Washington. Montgomery, thanks very much.
Thank you for having me.
Well, still ahead today, a Jewish man from Boston and a Palestinian Muslim together build a Jewish temple in Arkansas. That's after the news here and now. When the Dalai Lama meets with President Bush today and receives the Congressional Gold Medal tomorrow in Washington, his visit will certainly anger Beijing. The Dalai Lama is considered a god king by Tibetan Buddhists, but a separatist by the Chinese government because of his calls for autonomy for Tibet. Well, we may hear China's thoughts on the American visit because it comes as the elite of China's Communist Party gathers at the Great Hall of the People in Tiananmen Square for a week-long congress. This has been described as the big event of Chinese politics. It happens only once every 5 years, and it can map out the leadership of the party and the country for the next 20 years. Melinda Liu is Beijing bureau chief for Newsweek magazine. Melinda, President Hu Jintao and Prime Minister Wen Xiaobao aren't expected to retire until 2012. But I understand they're already talking successors, isn't that right? Melinda?
Yes, that's the main priority of the agenda of this Congress. The problem is we won't know the exact lineup for another week. There's been a lot of negotiating between factions, we hear, and maybe even a little bit of a surprise in that what everyone thought was a pretty predictable succession turned out to be not so predictable, and a younger leader who was not quite as much of a sure thing as people thought has sort of leapfrogged ahead to become the likely successor of Hu Jintao.
Is this Li Keqiang?
No, that's the interesting thing. Li Keqiang was considered the presumed heir apparent until just a couple of weeks ago. And now it appears that the person who will, of that same generation, the younger generation, who's actually going to be higher ranking than Li Keqiang, is a man named Xi Jinping, who's the party secretary of Shanghai, which, of course, is a very important position.
Well, what does that tell you that there's been, I mean, obviously, as you said, this can get complicated and netty, but what does that mean that there's been that sort of switcheroo?
Well, what it means is that, first of all, that Hu Jintao, although he's considered a relatively young leader who's consolidated power quite a bit over the recent years, that he has not managed to consolidate power to the point where his will is considered dominant. It sounds like Xi Jinping was a compromise candidate, acceptable to Hu Jintao, but not his favorite.
You write about how leadership in China is a generational thing, and that coming up is the sixth generation from Mao. These are the younger potential leaders. Tell us about that, because you write that these younger leaders could be China's last best hope for political change. That word last really jumped out at me. What do you mean by that and this sort of generational sense of leadership?
The Communist Party does not elect its leaders. And so as one way to sort of institutionalize the succession, people are used to thinking of generations of leaders led by the person who ended up at the top. Mao, of course, is where it all began. And Hu Jintao, our current party head, is the head of the fourth generation. Xi Jinping, who seems to be his likely successor now, is the fifth generation, and the sixth generation is the generation of leaders in their 40s, many of whom will be coming up through the ranks, whose names will be sort of emerging in the national consciousness for the first time. But that generation is not expected to actually be at the top leadership of the country until the year 2020 or so. Why do we consider this generation to be so important in terms of change in China is because, first of all, the system is very ossified. The lack of elections means that it's quite a process to ensure that the leader of China is also a leader with popular support. Secondly, leaders in their 40s are better educated, educated in different fields. The current leadership is all, are nine people who are all trained as engineers. But in the sixth generation, we see people trained in law, people trained in agriculture, economics, and so forth. And then why the last best chance for change? Because there is a growing understanding that the party has to change, or its very survival may be at risk. For one thing, it's a system that's very ponderous, it's a system that's had problems with corruption, and even the top leaders themselves, it's not just me saying this, have talked about corruption and incompetence as something that has to be rooted out on a very comprehensive way. Otherwise, the party may not be able to survive, which is, you know, a very candid assessment. China is very much aware that communism and socialism has, in many other countries, basically collapsed. And so in order to stay relevant, there are lots of hopes being pinned on this younger generation, the sixth generation, because they seem so much more internationalized and globalized than their elders.
It's interesting because you write in one place that some of these members of the sixth generation came of age in the 60s, might have actually been protesters in Tiananmen Square so many years ago. But then you also write that those who might have been protesting in Tiananmen Square need not apply for a role in, you know, party leadership. So which is true? I mean,
what we need to understand is that when the protests first began in Tiananmen Square in 1989, a huge number of university students, especially in Beijing, would have taken part because in the very beginning it was not considered an anti-government display. But at a certain point, after several weeks of demonstrations, the government finally came out and said, this is a counter-revolutionary act. At that point, those who continued to protest would have known that they were considered subversive. So that's what was meant in the article by saying that those who continue to protest after the demonstrations were declared to be subversive would have their loyalty being questioned. But let's face it, there were millions of people protesting before that point, you know, who did not think that they were doing anything counter-revolutionary. And that very likely included quite a lot of people in their 40s who are in important positions today.
But still, to have that generation, be now looking on the horizon to their possible leadership, you question, and others do, whether or not, you know, communism is even going to be in place when they assume their place, assume their leadership role.
I don't think we can rule out that possibility, that it would be gone. I mean, the assumption, of course, here is that it would still be around. There's also a question of whether it'll still be around in its current incarnation. You could also end up with a party with very strong factional interests. We already are seeing a pretty intense factional struggle between at least two different camps, one that is very much identified with the economically fast-growing parts of China, and the other which is more concerned with the poor areas, the rural areas, the lower income people who might have been marginalized by some of this rapid economic growth.
Melinda Liu, Beijing Bureau Chief for Newsweek magazine. Melinda, thanks as always.
Thank you. My pleasure.
In this note, Melinda mentioned two of the factions within the Communist Party, one that's representing the richer parts of China, the other that's speaking for less developed parts. Well, yesterday, in a 2.5-hour speech, President Hu Jintao mapped out his goals for the next 5 years. He cited a long list of achievements, but also said the Communist Party needs to address environmental degradation, corruption, and the growing income gap between the rich and the poor. While he said there should be more intra-party democracy, he added the Communist Party must continue its monopoly on power. The party, he said, must remain the core that directs the overall situation and coordinates the efforts of all quarters. Quick look ahead tomorrow on Here and Now. Iraqi refugees in the U.S. A translator for the U.S. in Iraq is now stateside, unemployed, and she's wondering what's next. You're listening to Here and Now. Only in America. A Palestinian-American and a Jewish-American are working together to build a synagogue in Arkansas. Last weekend in Fayetteville, Arkansas, they gathered to break ground on Temple Shalom, a synagogue that will provide the first permanent home to the area's Jewish worshipers. Local contractor Palestinian-American Fadl Bayari is donating his services, and without that sacrifice of about $250,000, there would probably be no temple. We welcome first Fadl Bayari.
Thank you.
And Bill Feldman is the president of Temple Shalom. He joins us as well. Bill, welcome to you as well.
Thank you very much.
And, you know, we're not saying that Muslim and Jewish communities wouldn't be seen in Arkansas. I mean, Fayetteville, for instance, was on Forbes' best places to retire and best places for business, so it's a very forward-thinking town. But still, what are the chances, Bill, that you and a Palestinian would be working together in Fayetteville?
I think even though Fayetteville, as you said, is a very welcoming town and a wonderful atmosphere, I still think it's a very, very unusual situation for us. And our Bayari has been just so very, very generous, and the circumstances that we could meet together and share these interests has just been somewhat remarkable, both in terms of the circumstance and in terms of the generosity.
And Fadl, you're a practicing Muslim. You've been in the U.S. for close to 40 years. You're now a general contractor in Arkansas. Are there many other practicing Muslims in Fayetteville?
Not many, probably about 50 families.
Yeah. And Bill, what about you? We know you moved to Arkansas from Boston, from our area, more than 3 decades ago to teach math at the University of Arkansas.
Correct.
Now that you're building this temple, do we understand there wasn't a temple before?
I mean, exactly. And there were a small number of Jews when I first moved to Fayetteville. There were probably a dozen Jews that gathered every so often to meet together and to have services. The temple began in 1980 when there were perhaps 24 Jewish families that were interested in organizing a temple, but it's just today that we've come to the point where we can consider building a permanent temple.
Well, and I know somebody in the congregation offered to buy a home for you in a residential area to convert into a synagogue, but that caused some controversy among neighbors in the area. They didn't want traffic and such. But Fadl, you heard about this on a television report. What prompted you to then offer your services? That's a huge offer.
Well, it's several reasons. One of them, I was troubled with the fact that they got denied that rezoning because there is another church on top of Mount Sequoia where that house they were trying to buy, number one. Number two, I built a mosque in the city of Fayetteville 4 years earlier, and I had no problem with it. So it troubled me. And I thought, well, I have a Jewish friend named Ralph Nesson at Rotary. So I approached him and I said, is there any way I can help you? And that's when I told him I'll be glad to build their temple at cost. You know, in the back of mind, I'm really reaching out in friendship to bridge the gap between basically lost brothers. I felt all my life that there is a kinship right there between the Muslims and the Arabs and the Jews due to the fact that we both have the same forefather,
Abraham. Mm-hmm. Well, so, Bill, when this offer was made to you, you think what?
We were just thrilled that this not only was an offer by a very generous person, but also an offer by a Muslim that just indicated a warmth to us and a potential for interaction that was really overwhelming.
Does it translate into anything else, Bill?
Well, for us, it translates into an interfaith dialogue, a better understanding between faiths. In fact, what we hope to do is to dedicate this, we call it a temple of peace, to a continuation of an understanding between diverse people.
How about on your part, Fadl? Because you still have family back on the West Bank and in Jordan. Do I understand that?
Yes, I do.
How does this look from their point of view?
They're extremely supportive. Everybody over there that I know, my family and friends, they're eager for peace with the Israelis and our Jewish brothers. And I think this is unique in itself because it basically shows what people can do when they have their heart in the right place.
That's Fadl Bayari. He's the general contractor for the construction of Temple Shalom in Fayetteville, Arkansas. Bill Feldman is the president of Temple Shalom. I want to thank you both and best of luck to you.
Thank you very much.
Have a good day, Bill.
Thank you. You too, Fadl. Talk to you soon.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Much has been made recently about the current administration's push to expand the powers of the presidency. Boston Globe reporter Charlie Savage wrote a book about it from an outsider's view. Conservative Harvard Law professor and former administration official Jack Goldsmith wrote From the Inside. But running parallel to the push for presidential power is the story of power already achieved by the current vice president.
He believes that the president should have the final word, indeed the only word, on all matters within the executive branch.
It's a direct showdown constitutionally between the president and Congress.
In the new Frontline documentary, Cheney's Law, we hear of a Dick Cheney stung by the fall of Richard Nixon in the 70s, defensive of the Reagan administration's role in the Iran-Contra scandal in the 80s, and determined in present day to push for more presidential power. Michael Kirk directed Cheney's Law, which airs tonight on Frontline, and he joins us.
Thank you, Rob.
Michael, much of the film is about memos regarding treatment of detainees, warrantless wiretapping of Americans, a bedside visit to strong-arm White House officials, things once secret and now public. But Dick Cheney has never made a secret of his intent to expand the power of the Oval Office.
No, it's always the only secret has been, or the only question has been, is it philosophical or personal? Does he have a long-standing desire to set this up for any future president, or is it all about power for a Republican president? That was the question, and we've come down to that kind of place where it's, yes, it's personal because he loves to go one-on-one, but it's also philosophical. He really wants to set up for the long-term future presidents to have enhanced power and the Congress to have very little.
All future presidents?
All future presidents. I think that's without question given what they've done. Now, they've also done a lot of sneaky things inside all of the legislation. The vice president's lawyer, David Addington, is himself the reader of all of the legislation that moved through the White House. Anything that happened, Addington went in there looking for a line, looking for a paragraph, looking for something that would either stop people encroaching on presidential power or enhance the power of the presidency. That means that woven deep inside everything that's happened domestically and in national security is this notion that the presidential powers that they want to flow from this office and to this office to the rest of the government are there for a very long time.
Well, let's talk about David Addington. He recently succeeded Scutellibby as Cheney's chief of staff, but he was Dick Cheney's legal counsel. And they've known each other for a long time.
They met in Congress when Cheney was pushing very hard. He goes to Congress after being a young chief of staff for Gerald Ford. He goes off to Congress when Carter wins the election. He hates Congress. He gets on a committee that is sitting in judgment over what Reagan did or didn't do in Iran-Contra. Cheney's policy perspective, which is, gee, I'd really like to see the president have more power, meets Addington's constitutional perspective, which is, I can help you do it because I know the law. And they form a partnership that lasted through Bush 1 and through this administration.
Another very powerful person in the last several years many Americans may never have heard of is John Yoo. Who was John Yoo?
John Yoo was a 34-year-old up-and-comer inside the conservative legal circles. He gets a job at the Office of Legal Counsel at the Justice Department, as somebody in our film says, the most powerful office you've never heard of, the mini Supreme Court inside the executive branch of the government.
The Office of Legal Counsel, they tell the president what is legal for his office to do.
Exactly right. They give him a hunting license, a fishing license, or they're the stoppers. They say, absolutely not, Mr. Right. President.
Well, just a few days after 9/11, when Congress was debating giving war powers to President Bush, David Addington, at that time lawyer to Dick Cheney and Cheney, go to the OLC, convinced the White House doesn't need congressional approval. They asked John Yoo to write a legal memo expanding presidential power. Here from your film is Yoo on the writing of that memo. He's followed by Jack Goldsmith, who was head of the OLC but left in 2004 after challenging the White House. He's speaking to you after he left. And we begin with John Yoo.
The Justice Department had long thought that Congress cannot limit the commander-in-chief power, that Congress cannot tell the president how to exercise his judgment as commander-in-chief. The law as they were written and the Constitution that we have gives the president a lot of power in wartime. The president is the commander-in-chief.
The truly remarkable thing about the opinion, it went beyond the idea that the president didn't need Congress's authorization and said that there was nothing that the Congress could do to stop the president from doing these things.
Who is Jack Goldsmith?
Jack Goldsmith was one of John Yoo's close friends, who was also another young conservative up-and-comer.
But Jack Goldsmith does not follow the game plan. He reverses the Bush administration decisions on treatment of prisoners.
The first ruling that he made a decision about was about whether terrorists in Iraq who are arrested would should be covered by the Geneva Convention. He does that within 1 week. He's asked that question within 1 week of coming on the job. He rides down to the White House with Patrick Philbin from the Justice Department, one of the deputies, and Philbin says to him, they're not going to like this at all. They've never been told no. Addington argues with Goldsmith in the first instance about that, and he will come to argue with Goldsmith about everything. One of the things that Addington says to Goldsmith is, if you continue to do this, the blood of 100,000 people will be on your hands.
People who will die in the next attack that you'll be responsible for. Let me ask you this before we move on in your storyline, Michael Kirk, because two things. First of all, as you well know, there are people listening saying, good on them. It was post 9/11, and we needed to have that kind of toughness.
Absolutely.
And secondly, other administrations have stockpiled justice departments with their own lawyers. So where does this become as extreme as you, reporter Charlie Savage, and ultimately Jack Goldsmith say it was?
I think when it went off the rails in terms of what people would expect to have happen is when the process became a rubber stamp. I mean, John Yoo was called by John Ashcroft, the attorney general at the time, no flaming liberal. Mm-hmm. He was called Dr. Yes.
Well, with this sort of epic intra-conservative struggle comes to a real fever pitch at that now infamous scene at then-Attorney General John Ashcroft's hospital bed. He'd been taken to the hospital. This is while the fight over warrantless wiretapping was waging. The then-White House counsel, Alberto Gonzalez, and White House Chief of Staff Andrew Card were trying to get Ashcroft to sign on to renewing warrantless wiretapping. He'd said he wouldn't want to. They race to his hospital bed, and Jack Goldsmith is there as well. Let's hear his account.
Attorney General Ashcroft kind of lifted himself up and gave about a 2 or 3 minute speech to Gonzalez and Card, in which he basically showed enormous, unbelievable clarity about what the issues were, and he explained why he also would not approve the program, and he read them a bit of the Riot Act. And with that extraordinary performance, and it was just an amazing, one of the most amazing things I've ever seen in my life, because he went from seeming, you know, near death to having this amazing moment of clarity. And I really worried at that point that he was going to expire. And I mean, it looked like he gave it the last of his energy. Gonzalez and Card quickly left, and that was the end of it.
For me, it was the reason we made the film in lots of ways. I read it in the newspaper when in March, and I said to David Fanning, the executive producer, I've got to go make this film because I've got to know what led up to this moment and what followed from this moment. It is, by the account of many people in Washington, the most astonishing thing that has ever happened in the American government in a theatrical sense. Jack finally puts his foot down, risks his career. It is truly a historical moment.
And it was somewhat explosive when it came out. And here's my question to you, Michael Kirk. People don't seem to care. There hasn't been a response to it. Why do you think that
is? Well, the vast majority of Americans with very busy lives see one thing, see another thing. My point is that a lot of things like that have occurred, but I'm not sure modern journalism has the time, the energy, the format, the place to deal with pulling it all together periodically. This is my 10th film about the war in Iraq and the war on terror, and every one of them keep coming back to this one central nexus, which is the office of the vice president, whether I wanted to or not, and that's important to know.
Michael Kirk's film, Cheney's Law, airs tonight on Frontline. For interactive features on the program and to see a list of local PBS stations, go to our website, here-now.org. Michael, thank you.
You're welcome.
You can listen to Here and Now live each weekday at noon Eastern Time by going to WBUR.org and clicking on the Listen Live button. You can also find us each weekday at noon Eastern on XM Radio Channel 133.